Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2022 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2021, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. Katrina Nanasted is an award-winning Australian author. We Are Wolves was shortlisted in the 2021 CBCA Awards, in the 2021 BookLink Awards, and the 2021 Queensland Literary Awards, as well as being longlisted in the 2021 ABIA Awards and winning the Best Designed Children's Fiction Book at the 2021 ABDA Awards and the BookLink's Historical Fiction Prize. We Are Wolves also won the 2021 inaugural ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category. The days of me reading or watching CYA are long gone. The closest I've probably come was the spoof, Five Go Mad on Mescaline, with George, Anne, Julian and Dick slightly reconfigured. But in the haze of everything, I do remember the impact these types of texts had on me. So it was with trepidation and intrigue that I read We Are Wolves. The writing, the subject matter, were all very diverse to what I'd imagined. So it's with great pleasure I welcome Katrina to HNSA's Imagining the Past 2022 podcast series.
Hi, thanks.
Of course, last year, amongst other wonders, We Are Wolves won the inaugural CYA category of the ARA Historical Novel Prize. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. That was very, very exciting.
So to start with today, I'd just like to kind of ask you what, you know, why did you become a writer? What was the kind of first inkling you had to become a writer?
Oh, that's always a bit of a tricky thing to pinpoint the moment. But interestingly enough, I wasn't interested in writing. I didn't even particularly like books and reading as a small child, which I think I'm the only children's author I've ever heard say that. But really, I was shown such boring, boring books when I was a child. And it's interesting you mentioned the spoof on The Famous Five, because I really didn't like Enid Blyton, which was flavour of the month when I was a little girl. So that put out a whole heap of reading material for me. But I was probably more of a math science student at school, but right at the end of school, I had this passionate English teacher and I caught her passion for literature, and so much so that I went on to university to study and I became a primary school teacher. But by that stage, my favourite thing really was books and reading, and my favourite time in the classroom was always when we would sit down together as a class and share a book. I just really, really loved the magic that a book could draw us all in together to a whole new world. And then when I had my own children, again, that was one of my favourite times of the day, when I snuggled up on the lounge with my two little boys and we dived together into a magical new world in a book. And I think probably that was the point at which I've thought, oh, hang on, I'd really like to be a part of this book magic. I think I'd really like to get serious about trying to create some of this story magic for children myself. And that was at the point where I started writing in earnest. I mean, I'd made sort of small half-hearted attempts before that, but I think really that was the time where I thought, you know, I'm really passionate about this. I'm going to give this a go.
Yeah, that's quite a journey to have come from science back to literature.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you feel the science helped you as a writer, or did it hinder you?
Oh no, not at all. I think just as a student, that was my strong point, was more that sort of side of things. I've never studied that at beyond school level. Yeah, I think it's just that was what my bent was. And it wasn't until I had this teacher who just really showed me how beautiful words and stories could be and all the layers that could be within one sentence or one story that I got really excited about the possibilities there.
No, teachers, I think, are marvellous.
Yes, yes. I mean, a good teacher changes your life.
You know, I think a good it's teacher true.
Has such influence over children.
And what drew you with writing children, young adult fiction to historical fiction? Because I think some of your other ones are not historical fiction. And then was it The Girl Who Brought Mischief was the first historical fiction?
Yes. Yeah, so generally I'm drawn towards writing the sorts of books that I wish I had read as a child, and I still aim to do that with my historical fiction. So I often look at writing humour and action and adventure and stuff that's a bit more lively than the books I was shown as a child and have a bit more fun about them than the books I was shown as a child. So I write a lot of humour, but, you know, wrapped in mystery and adventure and all sorts of things. So The Girl Who Brought Mischief was my first historical fiction, but I never really considered it as being that. It was just a story I was working on that was influenced a bit by a story idea I had of this person going to a remote island and really changing the population there through their fun and their sparkly personality. And I set it on Bornholm because I'd been to Bornholm. My husband's Danish, and I had this love for this beautiful little island we'd visited, and also had a bit more understanding of Danish culture, and had my husband there as a as a resource to ask any questions about things I didn't know. So that was sort of really more the story and the fun of it and the cultural connection that I had to Denmark that led me to write that story. So it really wasn't until much later that I got back to that historical fiction, and it was a bit of an accident. I was looking for a story online that I'd read about Denmark once again, and I came across this online Danish news article about the Wolfskinder, and I hadn't heard of the Wolfskinder before, and so I read on, as you do, and I was fascinated, so I just followed all the links. You know, I disappeared down the rabbit hole in a good way, as it turned out in this case. And when I pitched my next story idea to my publisher, I just mentioned the Wolfskinder in passing and said, what a fascinating story. And my publisher wrote back and said, oh yes, we would love to hear that idea when you've developed the story idea, which I didn't have a story idea. And so I set out to develop a story idea, set out in earnest and started doing more research and planned the story. And that really has opened this whole new line of writing for me, which I absolutely love. I just love the whole research and writing of historical fiction.
Isn't that the great thing of writing, though, that you just have these absolutely kind of random intersections with something, and you could, if you just weren't in the right mood that day, have looked the other way and just not quite responded to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I love that image. I can't remember who said it, but that there are stories out there waiting for someone to write them, and if you don't seize onto it, it'll float around until the right person grabs onto it next time and does something with it. And I think, you know, often you see stories come up that I think, oh yeah, I'd looked at that bit of history or that idea and thought that would be fun, but never really thought much more about it, but someone's taken it and made something beautiful out of it. So you're right, you need to be ready to seize that story. And I suppose I sort of like to think, you know, you find the right one that really excites you and is the one that's good for you to be writing.
The novel's a beautiful object. I mean, one of the first things that struck me when it was one of the first things that struck me when I saw it. And it does remind me of, you know, some of the books that I really treasured when I was younger. The illustrations that are delightful. I'm just wondering how that partnership came about with Martina. I'm not sure how to pronounce her name.
Heidecheck, I think it's pronounced.
Yeah. How did that partnership come about?
Well, usually it's your publisher who chooses an illustrator, and my publisher had suggested a particular illustrator who I hadn't had anything to do with before, but I didn't feel like it was really a great fit to my work. And so she sent me Martina's name and her pictures, and I went onto her website and immediately thought, oh, she's just perfect. And so I think Martina's heritage is German as well. So her pictures have this beautiful, many of them have this beautiful European feeling. She does beautiful towns and landscapes, and they're just gorgeous illustrations, anything that I've looked at of hers. And I said, yes, I think that would be absolutely fabulous. So it just went from there. And she's illustrated my next historical novel and is in the process of illustrating the third one now. And I love her pictures. There are full page pictures inside the text as well as the beautiful cover. And they're just full of emotion and meaning. And I adore them. I think they add so much to the book. And they've been something, I think, that's really drawn other people to the books. I'm sure a lot of people have first picked up my book because the cover's so beautiful with her artwork on it, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, the illustrations, just even the fact they're black and white, just lends this kind of antique kind of look to them, but also there's just something so kind of dreamy about them or something. They're lovely.
Yeah.
And you use first person point of view and present tense. I'm just kind of wondering what the process was to decide to use that.
I've done that before in a few of my books, largely because I really enjoy the immediacy of that, and I love that narrator's point of view, that they're the one telling the story as it happens to them, like right here and now. I love the immediacy of that and the chance for the narrator to be really involved and emotionally involved in the story. But here with the historical fiction, it also was a very deliberate choice because it allowed me to manage what I told young readers. So this story, We Are Wolves, is a really serious story. It's happened, these things happened to real people, and there was really tragic, traumatic stuff that happened around all these events that my characters go through. So I needed a way that I could navigate that and be honest without exposing young readers to things that they really shouldn't be exposed to. And so if I had one of my main characters narrating this story, I could only tell what they could see and understand. And that was a really great way for me to navigate around the events I didn't want to share with younger readers while not softening or pretending those things didn't happen.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah. No, the first person narrative, it's like when in writing a mystery or like a murder mystery, the first person is quite good because it allows you to occlude bits of information. So I can see how you've deployed that in the text.
Yes,
yeah.
And I think too, in a story like this, you can have your character witnessing things and explaining them as they understand, but a reader who's got a little bit more historical knowledge will actually read more into it than the reader who'll just take that at face level as well.
Yeah.
So it allows for readers at different stages of understanding and maturity to come in and all access the story at their own level. And I think that's really, really a powerful tool too when you're telling a story.
I'm just wondering, as a writer, as a reader, I think I really miss irregular past participles when people write in present tense, because they add like a sonic kind of variation to the language. I'm just wondering if you miss them as a writer using present tense.
No, I like describing. I really like that first person thing that you describe it as it happens. We run, my coat gets caught on a branch, I trip, you know, all that sort of stuff. I love the immediacy of that. I think it takes a little bit more work getting it to sound authentic and urgent when it's first person. But I think if you really work at it, I think it can feel so much more dramatic and immediate. But it's not as easy, I don't think, always with those sorts of action scenes or any sort of, you know, when you're using anything to describe something that's happening here and now. But I think it can work.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's kind of an example of any choice you make in these kinds of things when you're planning out a novel and starting a novel, any choice you make has advantages and disadvantages. So, you know, with first person, as you've said, you know, you gain the advantage of being in one person's point of view, so you can include other things if you want to. But at the same time, your character has to be everywhere to see everything. So that creates another kind of problem, you know, as a writer, you have
to solve. Yeah, and I suppose then the way in this story that I've solved that thing of not being able to be everywhere at once is when the children meet other children who can give them news of the world further beyond them, or other characters who know more that they meet along the way. There's that sort of device that you can use there as well, that they're then being informed of the world beyond. But it does, there are challenges, but I suppose with any way that you choose to narrate a book, there are going to be challenges. And I think you get into the groove of whatever yeah. style you choose. Once you get going, you really get into that groove and get better at it.
I'm just wondering if you have a sense with the writing that you are kind of educating and enlightening and inspiring younger readers, as I feel kind of I was by the stuff that I read when I was younger.
Yes, I hope so. I definitely write with my audience in mind. I think, you know, when you're writing for children, you need to be mindful that you're writing for young children. And my aim is always to entertain and to leave my readers with a sense of satisfaction. And if it's a serious story, a sense of hope, not with a sense of desperation that isn't the world gloomy and terrible, but a sense of, you know, bad things might happen, but there are kind, good people in the world and there is hope. So I definitely have that in mind. But also, yes, I think with historical fiction, I am aware of sharing new information with children. And I think that's one of the beauties of historical fiction, and one of the reasons adults love historical fiction, myself included, is that we read a great story that really engrosses us, engages us, and yet we can also feel like we're learning something along the way. And so that's certainly part of what I feel like your role is as an author with historical fiction. Not that you're writing a textbook and not that you're going to give every fact in there, but you want it to be accurate and to create some sort of sense of what that stage of history was like for your characters.
Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest things. It also to inspire people to go away from your novel and actually look at, you know, history textbooks and find out about things.
And I think certainly in writing historical fiction for children, it's a safe way to share history, because many of these events that we talk about in history are horrendous. Horrendous things happen during war, and you can't just, with young children, you can't just go and research whatever you can find, because they'll come across things that are totally inappropriate for them to be reading and exposed to at their age. So when we write an historical story, we are able to sort of just contain the things that are age appropriate for them, enough to give them an idea and give them a starting point to discuss those issues and that stage of history without giving them too much that's not really safe for them to know at that stage.
Yeah, I think that is something that kind of struck me when I was reading it. As I said, I've not read children, young adult fiction for a very long while. But so what age group do you think this is aimed at?
I think it's probably appropriate for 10 years and up. I know a couple of people have read it with younger children, but I would say 10 years and beyond is safe. It's aimed at the middle grade group, but I've also had a lot of adults been reading it too, which is really nice. But, yeah, certainly I would not say any younger than 10, unless you're reading it with your child or you've read it beforehand and know that your child will cope with the content of the story.
Yeah. I mean, you've kind of touched on this point a little bit as well, but, I mean, despite all the drama of the novel, it does kind of all work out. And I'm just kind of, I felt a bit worried while I was reading it for the child who's kind of suffered, you know, great permanent loss at a young age, who's reading this novel, whereas in the novel, you know, the family are kind of reunited. Mia almost dies but doesn't. The grandfather, the grandmother and the father are still possibly alive, you know, after the story ends, there's a possibility they might all meet up. And even, you know, the dreadful Charlotte is still out there kind of wandering around. I just kind of wondered if you thought about that, you know, that it is, I understand why it all works out, but I mean, that's kind of one of the themes of the novel, but it does kind of alienate someone who's already suffered great loss.
Yes, but I believe that we need a sense of hope and satisfaction in stories. I think even adults, most adults I know want stories to have a sense of resolution or hope at the end. And I did actually plan it originally with a different ending, and I just thought after everything my little characters had been through, I just couldn't do that to them or to my readers. I felt like there needed to be a satisfactory resolution. But the other thing is, I've read a lot of real history about people during war, true stories, and people do have the most astonishing reunions where you think, how could that possibly have happened in the chaos and the separation and everything that happens during war? You know, that people still manage to be reunited with their families. And so I don't believe it's really unrealistic for that to have happened in my story, but also I don't believe that it would have been in the best interests of my readers generally if I'd have had a really tragic ending. I think people would have hated the book, actually.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying, Greg, for the reader, for the young reader who perhaps has not had a happy resolution in their life. Yes, I do understand that. And I'm not sure I really have an answer for that.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of the things that I thought were really well done was just the fact that we had gone into a German family and saw all the different perspectives of that. And even as the novel progresses, the Russians were kind of the enemy, but then you humanize them as well. So was that hard to do, to kind of try and strike some of those balances?
Yeah, it was, because I didn't, you know, you don't want to make out that people who did terrible things didn't do terrible things. But I really wanted to make the point that even though there are people on both sides of any conflict that do terrible things, there are also people on both sides who are kind and mortified by what's going on. I suppose my challenge throughout the whole story, not just with that thing about the kind Russians and the kind Germans, was to make sure I was honest about what happened and was respectful of the suffering that people really went through, while also making the story accessible to young readers, appropriate for young readers, and also making the point that there are good people on both sides of any conflict, and often good people get drawn up into the drama and the tragedy that's started by a few misguided, wicked people.
I must admit that it was quite confronting reading the novel during the nightly images on the news of the Ukraine war, with all the fleeing and destruction there. No doubt, you know, there are now more than a few wolf families in the Ukraine or outside the country now. I'm just wondering, does what this repetition of history tells us about the role of history in historical fiction?
Yes, that's a really big question, isn't it? And I know that when the conflict first broke out, many people started saying to me, oh, your book's suddenly relevant, you know, become incredibly topical because of what's happening in Europe at the moment. And I just burst into tears every time someone said that to me, because I didn't want my book to be current. I was hoping I was just recording something in history. But of course, history does repeat itself, doesn't it? I hope, though, that when we write a story that talks about hope in these, which sounds like a really privileged thing to talk about in the middle of a war situation, but where we talk about that there are kind people on both sides of any conflict, that we remember not to not to paint everyone with the same brush, so to speak, that to know that there are good people on both sides of any conflict, people who don't want war, many, many people who don't want war, no matter what side they're on. And they just, I think the reality is that most people just want to live in peace with their families and friends and live a happy, simple life. But the reality is that history does sort of repeat itself, and there are people who start conflict that the rest of the world doesn't want. I don't think I've even answered that question, Greg, but it's a sad reality, isn't it, that history does seem to repeat itself.
It was really confronting to read it during that time. It did, and I don't know what the answer to the question is, because you would hope that, you know, the fact that we've written all these things down would kind of guard the future, but it doesn't seem to. I'm just wondering what you would change with this novel if you were going to write it as an adult novel, and if you, you know, do you ever have plans to write an adult novel?
Yeah, I have actually thought that with the last few children's books I've written that are historical, because there's a world of research you do, as you know, with any historical novel that never makes it to the book. It's important for that background for you as the writer to feel like you've got an accurate idea of what was going on. And I suppose often I think there's more that I could put in if I wrote of the story for adults, but I'm not sure I would really want to. I found the stories really, I really enjoyed the process, but I also found this book quite traumatic to write, because I was immersed in all these true stories and the history of what went on at that time and in those places. And I'm not sure if I was writing an adult book whether I'd just find it too overwhelming, because not only would I be reading that, I'd be living that in my characters and in my words, putting more detail in than I would with children. I think though adults still read the book and fill in the gaps too, even when adults are reading the children's book.
I think that's true. I think there is a process of, I felt that when I was reading it.
It's interesting because I think children take, as I said, children read it with whatever knowledge they've got, and they either take it at face value or they add a bit more in to what Liesl's describing, depending on what they know. But I know adults have read the book and said things like, oh, I was really worried about little Mia and how she would be affected long-term by the lack of food at her tender little age, and things like that that adults worry about that I don't think children have considered in reading the book. And so I suppose a well-told story will have all those layers depending on what the reader brings to it. Yeah, I think your question was, would I write for adults, and what would I change? And I think, no, I don't think I want to write for adults. And I have, in fact, tried at one stage, and my story just all became a little bit twee once more. And I thought, no, I think I've really found my voice as a children's author, and it's hard to move away from that.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be. I'm always interested in the research process, you know, both the macro and the micro, but a few years back, I helped a Hungarian man write his memoir, and he spoke of the Russians' obsession with watches. Like, many of them wore many watches up their sleeves. Some of them took large clocks to the Budapest clockmakers to have them reduced to watches. I'm just wondering how you found out about this obsession with watches.
Oh, I found an amazing book called The Death of East Prussia, which sounds like quite a dry title, but it was a brilliant book that talked about what happened in East Prussia before and during and after the end of the war. And it also talked extensively about what happened with the Red Army when they marched into East Prussia. And it talked about, you know, the disparity between the people in Russia and the Soviet Union just really barely eking out an existence, and then marching into Germany and seeing such wealth and just seeing things like watches and bicycles and kitchen appliances for the first time in their lives, and just thinking, look how rich these people are. Why have they moved into our poor country and taken everything? So there was this certain amount of overwhelm at the wealth and the technology and stuff, I suppose. And there was also that thing of revenge that happened there. And I think Stalin did actually allow his soldiers to loot once they moved onto German soil. And so there was this thing that there was in a, there was the revenge thing. There was the thing that we're overwhelmed at all this stuff we can see all of a sudden, but also things like watches and different things could be sent back to Russia and to other families in the Soviet Union where they could then sell those things and buy food to survive another week or another month. And so there's all those factors at work there. But the watch thing's a fascinating thing, isn't it? And I actually read an article about, you know, that famous picture when the Red Army raised the flag over the Reichstag building in Germany, in Berlin. Do you know, are you familiar with that photograph? And apparently that, you know, the Reichstag building was burnt out in the 30s, so, but it was symbolic of German rulership and leadership. So raising the Soviet flag over the top was a very symbolic gesture. And this article suggested that that what's the American one where they're on an island in the South Pacific where there's that really famous photograph where the soldiers raise the American flag.
Yeah, there's the clump of kind of someone's kneeling and it goes to a higher person and they've got the flag.
Yeah, yeah. That it was modelled on that photograph apparently. And when the photographer, the Soviet photographer came and took that photo, he actually had to doctor out a watch that was on the soldier's wrist because they didn't want it to be shown that they were doing this terrible looting thing, apparently. So I don't know how accurate that is, but I thought that was a fascinating story too, that they wanted to sort of, it wouldn't be Photoshop in those days, but remove that watch from the Soviet soldier's wrist. So any sort of negative, you know, links to what was going on with the Soviet soldiers was removed from that really iconic shot.
Yeah, well, it was a kind of surprise for me because I'd heard this story and then it turned up some in your novel. It was quite quite a surprise for me. So just to finish up today, I was just wondering, you know, how you feel about the ARA Historical Fiction Prize, the CYA category and its inception and what you think these prizes kind of do.
Oh, I think it was really exciting to win the award. It was really, especially the inaugural one. I think it's great that children's literature is being acknowledged in this way. And I think it's an incredible encouragement to authors when they do win an award. And this award's actually a really, really generous award too. So it actually makes a difference in a writer's life. I think it gives you a sense of freedom in that you think, well, I've earned this good amount of money here for the year that allows me a little bit of freedom as to what I say yes to, what I say no to, which potentially gives you more time to sit down and work at your stories rather than worrying about how you're going to earn a living. They're a really great encouragement to authors, but I think too they're great because they do actually promote the books too that are shortlisted. And I think this particular award has been fantastic at doing that, at really promoting all the shortlisted authors and their books, so that not only do you have that affirmation that your book's been well written and well received, but it promotes it out in the wider community so that, you know, that people are aware, more aware of your book being there, which that all really helps as an author. It helps enormously.
Yeah. So what's next for you? What's the next projects?
I'm currently working on just editing my third historical novel, which is called Waiting for the Storks, which is also, I hope, about a lesser known aspect of World War II, about a little Polish girl who's taken during World War II. And so I'm in the sort of final stages of editing that, and it'll be out at the end of the year. And I'm also writing a lighter series for young readers, not historical fiction, called The Travelling Bookshop, which is like fantasy, adventure, humour. So it's a nice balance between the heavier historical fiction and writing that's a bit more playful, a bit lighter.
And you have a new one out at the moment. Is it Rabbit Soldier Angel Thief?
Yes, at the end of last year that came out, Rabbit Soldier Angel Thief, which is inspired by a real story. It's fiction, but it's inspired by the story of a real little boy who was joined the Red Army at, they think he was somewhere between 6 and 8 years of age, and he served throughout the war. So it's a story about a little Russian boy who becomes a soldier and joins a Red Army unit and serves with them to start from Stalingrad right across to Berlin at the end of the war.
Wow, so that sounds interesting. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I've enjoyed our discussion.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2022 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction, including details of the announcement of the 2022 ARA Historical Novel Prize on the 20th of October, 2022. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.